From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. What's your favorite Southern drink?
Well, I love an old-fashioned, and because I love the bourbon. And it's a very smooth drink and one that I enjoy in the evening.
We'll get a crash course in mixology this hour. First, though, last night, Georgia restaurants were packed for Valentine's Day. Treating your sweetheart is great, but do you always tip your server well? Our breakroom gang recently talked about whether or not tips should go out and higher wages should come in.
If we want to pay a wage, then we've got to acknowledge that a $40 steak dinner goes to being a $75 steak dinner, right? I think if people are getting taken care of, that it's coming from the right place. And that should be from the pockets of the people who are enjoying the experience.
Mm-hmm. That's Democratic strategist Howard Franklin. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Roper. I live in Forsyth County, Georgia. I think that tipping should be done away with in favor of living wage.
My name is Katie Trent. I'm calling from Decatur, Georgia. I just wanted to weigh in because I've worked in kitchens in Atlanta for several years and never, not once, has the front of house ever tipped out the back of the house.
We love hearing what you think, so call us at 404-500-9457. Also, you can find us on social media at OST Talk on Twitter, and we might feature your comments on the show. The story begins with a disappearance.
People disappear all the time. Young girls run away from home. Children stray from their parents and are never seen again. Housewives take the grocery money in a taxi to the train station. Most are found eventually. Disappearances, after all, have explanations. Usually.
Those are the opening lines from Outlander. The Starz TV series is based on a series of books about the adventures of a nurse named Claire. She's a time-traveling British beauty who must navigate life in two very different eras with two very different men. The story comes from the mind of author Diana Gabaldon. She was trained as a scientist with degrees in zoology, marine biology, and a PhD in quantitative behavioral ecology. But she is a novelist now, with 8 books that have been published in 26 countries and 23 languages. The very first Outlander book arrived 27 years ago. That's hard to believe. Book nine is in the works now. Diana Gabaldon speaks at the Savannah Book Festival at 6 p.m. tonight and joins me now. Hello there.
Oh, hi, Celeste. How are you?
You'll have to forgive me if I become a little bit of a fangirl instead of a journalist, because I've literally been reading your book since they very first came out.
Oh, that's great.
And I wonder, I mean, you have very famously said that this book was started as practice, right? You were actually seriously writing a novel.
Mm-hmm. I was seriously writing a novel, but I was writing it for practice in order to learn how to write a novel. But as I said to myself at the time, I make only 2 rules about this. One is that I will not stop, no matter how bad I think it is. I need to write the entire thing in order to learn what it takes in terms of commitment, daily discipline, mental organization, research, in order to write something, you know, that's not only fictional, but which I hadn't done before, if you don't count comic books. And, huge compared to, you know, the usual sort of scholarly articles and things. And the second rule was that I would do the best that I could every single day. Because I said, you know, if I'm not doing my best, how will I know if I'm any good? How will I get any better? So, I approached it very seriously, but I sure wasn't intending anyone to read it.
And then sold it as a trilogy.
I was fortunate enough to get an agent before I had finished writing the first book. And so it was another 6 months before I finished the manuscript. When I sent it to him, I said, well, you know, I have realized as it's coming together that there's more to this story. But I thought I should stop while I could still lift it. If anyone is interested in this, you could tell them there's more. So people were interested. And he sent it to 5 editors who he thought might like it. And within 4 days, 3 of them had called back with offers to buy it. And so he negotiated amongst those 3. And one of the things he told them was, she says, there's more. To which they all replied, well, trilogies are very popular these days. Do you think she could write 3? And being a good agent, he said, oh, I'm sure she could. So, you know, I became a novelist, you know, sort of overnight with a 3-book contract, which is, yeah, not usual, but very lucky.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, at that time, you were working on your PhD. I mean, you are a practiced researcher.
No, I already had a PhD.
You had your PhD. You knew how to research, but this was still during the time of just being able to Google everything.
Yeah, no, online did not exist. I mean, there was a sort of a crude precursor of the internet, you know, DARPANET and things like that. But those were purely for, you know, mostly military or industrial usage. There was no open to the public sort of thing.
Which shocks me because you had not been to Scotland when you wrote this first novel. And yet anyone who's read these books knows that you paint this just incredibly realistic picture of Scotland, from the landscape to the accent to the way that the buildings look. How did you do that?
The old-fashioned way with books. I went immediately to the library. I mean, I you probably know how I happened to choose Scotland. It was the whim of a moment based on having seen a young man in a kilt on a Doctor Who rerun. And I said, well, that's kind of fetching. Anyway, I said, you got to start somewhere. Why not Scotland, 18th century? Excuse me. So I went immediately to the library and started looking up Scotland in the 18th century. Well, luckily, Scotland is a very beautiful and deeply interesting country. B, it's accessible, you know, because it's part of the British Isles. So given modern travel and so forth, people go there a lot and they take pictures of it. And C, it's a very literate country with a very strong history, both of oral tradition and of written stories and so forth. The net result is that there's an enormous amount of written material about it, including pictures and including a great number of novels and stories written by Scottish writers, which is how I, as people put it, got the dialect. I just read books written by Scots. You know, it's fairly easy to pick out the patterns of Scottish dialect. And
for you. For you. No, I mean, I've read some very bad novels with bad imitations of Scottish dialect, and
so
we've all seen some actors who've done the Scottish accent just monstrously.
True enough, yes. You know, people often say to me, how did you get from being a scientist to being a novelist? And I said, well, easy, I wrote a book. But what they're really asking is, you know, how did you get from what they conceive as this cold, clinical, linear, tidy sort of thing into, you know, what they conceive as creative and colorful and, you know, warm and fuzzy and all that. And so it's the same thing. The same thing underlies science as underlies art. And what that is an ability to perceive patterns. Like you said, it's easy for me. I was luckily born with the ability to perceive patterns. And so if I look at something for very long, I begin to pick out the patterns, you know, just naturally. You can't analyze it, of course. I do think about it in some conscious detail, but, I mean, the patterns are there. And, you know, some people are better at this than others, I imagine, is what it comes down to. But if any sort of language pattern, at least English translations, German-speaking English, sounds much different than French people speaking English and so forth. And you pick up just the very crude patterns that they use in, you know, word order, word choice and things like that. Because what you're after when you're writing is to give the illusion of someone speaking rather than, you know, try to dissect it down to the actual component part. With the Scots dialect, it was a little more of a complete job, you might say, because I have people speaking in Scots dialect all the way through the book.
Yeah.
And they have to sound authentic and so forth. But as I say, you can do that. The other thing that I used was live performances. I would, you know, watch the BBC and pick out the Scottish actors and listen to their accents and their word choices. And I would listen to, back in the day, it was 8-track tapes, listen to tapes of Scottish bands, especially on a live performance. Not only do you get the dialect coming through the ballads and the traditional songs, but also the band will banter back and forth with the audience in between, and you pick up the more modern accent that way. But anyway, it was just sort of an immersion process, I guess you'd say.
So let's talk about Captain Black Jack Randall. We mm-hmm. actually asked a book club in Savannah if they had any questions for you. And that book club has read the entire Outlander series. Here's one response from Francis, who says, I've waited my entire life for this. I read the first two books when I was way too young to understand what was going on. What or whom was your inspiration for Captain Jack Randall? After 8 novels, it's likely you've hit writer's block once or twice. How do you continue to fuel your creativity and overcome moments of frustration in your writing? So that's 2 questions there. She actually has about 6 more. So let's just let's deal with Jack Randall first.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. He's not based on anyone. I mean, luckily, I don't know anybody like that. essentially, people always say, you know, well, where do you get these characters and so forth? Well, I mean, in essence, they're all me. I was once at a tea party that some fans in Phoenix do for me once in a while. They like to invite me out to tea and pick my brains as to what I'm doing. On one of these occasions, they got started on by Jack Randall, and they were saying, well, he's a loathsome, he's a scum, makes my skin crawl. And I'm sitting there sipping my Earl Grey and thinking, you have no idea you're talking to Black Jack Randall, do you? Because, I mean, they never do. But, you know, where else do these people come from? They're all me.
Well, let's hear on that slightly upsetting note. Captain Black Chan Randall is played. Jack Randall is played by actor Tobias Mingus in the Starz series. He also plays Frank Randall, Claire's first mm-hmm. husband, who's mm-hmm. a descendant of Black Jack. So here's the real actor talking about how he channels this guy.
I mean, I think he is a sadist. To my mind, I think that's what Diana has written, is a study in sadism. And but in a way to bring that to an audience, I have to be on his side if no one else is. Otherwise, I don't think it's interesting to watch them. You know.
And in a way, that's mm-hmm. that's maybe the key to creating a good villain, that you flesh them out. They're not all 100% bad.
Oh, exactly. No, I mean, everyone is human, even the least human amongst us. But people are multidimensional. I mean, unless they are just, you know, completely raving mad and have lost the plot completely. And, you know, your practicing sadist is actually fairly intelligent by and large.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I actually did a great deal of research into not sadism per se, but sort of what you might call the psychological complex of sadism and so forth. And when Tobias was cast, he actually asked me what could I tell him about Black Jack Randall. And in fact, I composed this entire dossier on Jack Randall. But some of the questions that Tobias asked me and some of the information I thought he had were to do with things that actually had nothing to do with what you might call the darker aspects of his character. It was with what kind of family did he come from? Were they aristocrats? Were they minor gentry? Were they tradespeople and he rose, you know, through the ranks? Or what background did he come from? What sort of language does he have? What sort of English does he speak? Is he extremely posh or, you know, rather crude in his language and aspect? And, you know, I told him as much as I knew or could discover in the crevices of my mind about Black Jack Randall, and used it all.
That's author Diana Gabaldon. She's best known for writing the Outlander series, and she speaks in Savannah tonight. Our conversation continues just ahead. This is On Second Thought.
Sing me a song of a lass that is gone. Say, could that lass be I? Mary of souls, she sailed on a day.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Let's get back to my conversation with author Diana Gabaldon. She headlines the Savannah Book Festival tonight. Her series of best-selling Outlander novels began in 1991 and have since spun off into a TV show on the Starz Network, a graphic novel, and a musical. So when I first read the first book, because my friend gave it to me in 1991, and mm-hmm. to be honest, the way that they had created the cover, I would never have read the book otherwise, because it looked
like a
romance novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was kind of ticked off because I felt it was sexist. I felt like if a man had written a rich historical novel with
uh-huh.
sex scenes in it, they would never mm-hmm. have put it in the romance category.
Yeah, no, you're dead right.
Let me actually play a little clip. This is Katrina Balfe, who plays Claire on the Starz series, and she's talking about how the show translated a pretty iconic sex scene from the book.
We didn't necessarily set out to make this, you know, female gaze type of sex scenes, but, you know, our source material is a female writer. We had a female director. We had a female writer of that episode. And, you know, I think we all just wanted to make something that was very true to their relationship and real.
What did you think about that early labeling of your novel as romance?
Oh, I disliked it intensely. And, well, I had never, of course, intended it to be a romance novel. I do read romance novels. I enjoy them. I've certainly read enough of them to know that's not what I wrote.
But this isn't one.
No, it isn't. Anyway, I learned much later that they had bought the book because the editor fell in love with it. And Jackie Cantor was my first editor, a wonderful person, very astute in all matters literary. Anyway, she was a general fiction editor, and she had bought the book because she fell in love with the book. You know, it would never have occurred to her to call it a romance novel because she does, in fact, know what romance novels look like. Anyway, I learned much, much later that she took it to an editorial meeting, and the first thing people say is, of course, well, what are you working? What have you bought lately? What is it? And she said, oh, I bought this wonderful book. You know, this is fantastic. Women do a wonderful job with it and with the marketing and everything. And they were getting excited and saying, well, that's great. You know, what kind of book is it? And she said, at that point, I sort of stopped and said, well, I don't know. And anyway, she tried to explain it. They were saying, oh, a science fiction. Well, we can put, you know, clocks on the cover. And she's going, no, we can't do that. Anyway, it took them 18 months of hassling to decide, A, that they were, in fact, going to publish the book. Their first impulse was to cancel the contract and give it back to me because they couldn't decide how to market it effectively. And they were all saying, according to my agent who conveyed this to me much ex post facto, they were all saying, well, we're going to put it out and it will just, you know, fall on its face and flop. No one will read it if they don't know what kind of book it is. Mind you, this was well before Amazon, and it was all books and mortar bookstores. A bookstore has shelves. Shelves have labels. A book can only go on one shelf in the bookstore, which means you got a real problem if you can't pick a label for that book. If you call it romance, I will never be reviewed by any literarily respectable venue like the New York Times, which is true. I never have been. I said, I can live with that. I said, on the other hand, if you do that, it will cut off the entire male half of my readership. So these are not women's fiction books. I said, men see different things in the story than women do, and I would hate for that perspective to be lost. Well, he was a man. He said, yes, I understand entirely. He said, we could insist that they call them science fiction or fantasy because of the odd aspect of the story. He said, but bear in mind, a bestseller in SFF is 50,000 in paperback. He said, a bestseller in romance is 500,000. I said, you got a point. So anyway, my thinking on this, and I did think considerably about it, was that my first editor did say to me, these have to be word-of-mouth books because they're too weird to describe to anyone, which is dead right. And I thought, well, that being the case, obviously it makes much better sense to expose them to an audience of 500,000 people who will all read them and rush out and tell their friends about them. And, you know, the word will spread to people who are not romance readers, rather than start with a very small and insular book niche market of 50,000, all of whom are people who I was going to say all of whom were people who don't read anything else, and that's not true at all. But it was truer back in the day than it is now. Anyway, I said, you know, all things considered, all right, let them publish the first paperback as romance. But we made a deal. I said, this is okay, as long as I get dignified covers, you know, no mad hair, no bosoms, nothing like that. You know, we don't want the swirly calligraphic titles. It needs to look dignified. And I said, my second condition is if the books become visible, which means hit the New York Times list in publisheries, at that point they will reposition the books as fiction, because at that point obviously they have enough of a presence that they, you know, worrying that no one will read them is not a problem. And so they very honorably did that. We got, you know, dignified, if female looking covers, and they did reposition them. Voyager, my third book, hit the New York Times list in hardcover, and they promptly recovered all of the paperbacks. Actually, what they did was put colored bars across the flowers, but they did stamp fiction on the spine. And Barnes & Noble, which was and still was the 800-pound gorilla at that point, luckily they're less influential these days. And nothing against Barnes & Noble. This is just how they worked in the day. Basically, they said, well, the first book you published by this author was a romance. So as far as we're concerned, everything she writes for the rest of her life is a romance. And they continued to shelve the books in romance for the next 8 years, which is how long it took me to make them stop. I finally succeeded in this. I lost my patience and my temper. And I wrote a very rude letter to Steve Riggio, who was their CEO at the time. And I said, dear Mr. Riggio, I'm assuming you might recognize my name since it shows up at the top of bestseller list fairly frequently. And I'm assuming you might also recognize my books since they take up a fair amount of real estate in your stores. I said, I assume that you have also heard of a bookstore chain called Hastings. I said, they're not Barnes & Noble, but they're not Chopped Liver either. At the time, Hastings had about 125 stores, and mostly in the western states. And I said, I assume that you don't know that Hastings sells 40% more of all my titles than you do. I do assume that you'd like to know why this is. Well, I'll tell you, Steve, they're not putting them in the effing romance section. Anyway, I sent this off expecting nothing, and I heard nothing for 6 weeks. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, I got a call from Mr. Riggio. We had a more or less civil conversation for 10 minutes or so, and he said, I'll have someone look into it. And I said, well, that's the last of that. But 24 hours later, sure enough, his vice president of marketing called up and said, well, we've looked into it, and you're right, we're moving the books. So at that point, they moved them to fiction, and we became at least semi-respectable.
I love that story. I mean, one more question for you, and it's about... You mentioned earlier that you kind of famously got inspiration to start this book from a character in Doctor Who. And mm-hmm. that character, when it came to your books, was Jamie Fraser, the wild Scottish guy who ends up marrying Claire, even though she's already married. It's complicated.
It's very complicated.
In any case, here is... And you have actually written a sub-series that featured Lord John Grey. He's just a minor carry in the main, and he becomes a British officer. And he's supposed to supervise a prison where Jamie Fraser is being held. So here he is, Lord John Grey, in the Star series. Somebody's telling him about who Jamie Fraser is.
You'll have heard of Red Jamie Fraser.
Of course. The man was notorious during the Rising.
Well, we have him. He's the only Jacobite officer here and the only man we keep chained. If matters arise, he acts as their spokesman. Guards are all afraid of him. Those that fought at Preston Pans say he's the devil himself.
So you started writing a novel about a Scottish man, young mm-hmm. Scottish man, but you ended up with Claire as the real sort of pivotal voice of the series, although these are big tomes of enjoyable books. They're, you know, there's not one character. How did that happen? When did you realize it was Claire that was the focus and the sort of the central voice and not Jamie?
Well, Claire's not the focus. She is, however, the narrator for the first book and the only person whose narration comes in a first-person voice, which causes a lot of people who don't understand what point of view actually is to say, well, she's telling the story. It must be all about her. But, you know, it's not. It's they pay attention to the story itself. No, I started, as you say, with Jamie. And mind you, I had never written any fiction before. And so I was just experimenting the first couple of days. I was just writing little half scenes about this man in a kilt, you know, just kind of thinking, well, who is he? What is he doing? You know, and no idea. At the same time, I was doing research in the library about Scotland in the 18th century. Well, at this point, the only thing I knew about writing novels for sure was that they should have conflict. And I said, okay, conflict, 18th century Scotland. Well, this was obviously the Jacobite Rising of the 45, which came immediately to view when you do a little historical research. And so I said, fine, good, that's a conflict, fine. I must have a lot of Scotsmen, of course, because of the kilt factor, and you have a war, and you get a lot of them. I said, good. I said, but I think that I might need a female character to kind of play off these guys, and we'll have sexual tension. That's conflict. That's good. So about the third day of writing, I said, okay, female character, who should she be? I thought, well, you know, on this very superficial reading, I said, it looks like a war between Scots and English. I said, so if I make her an English woman, we'll have lots of conflict. So on the third day of writing, I introduced this English woman. No idea who she was, what she was called, what she was going to do in the story. I just had her walk into a cottage full of Scotsmen to see what she'd do. Well, she walked in, and they were all crouched around the hearth, muttering to each other. They turned around and stared at her, and I was thinking, why, does she look funny? Is it just that she's English? You know, she hasn't even said anything yet. How do they know she's English? Anyway, all these questions, you know, go through your mind all the time while you're writing. But one of the men got up, and he said, my name's Dougal McKenzie, and who might you be? And without stopping to think, I just typed, my name's Claire Elizabeth Beecham, and who the hell are you? And I said, well, you don't sound at all like a historical person. So I fought with her for several pages, trying to beat her into shape and make her talk like an 18th century woman. She wasn't having any. She just kept making smart-ass modern remarks. And she also took over and more or less started telling the story herself, so to speak. And so I said, well, I'm not going to fight with you all the way through this book. I said, go ahead, be modern. I'll figure out how you got there later. And so that's why there's time travel, is just because it was the easiest thing to do.
That is Diana Gabaldon, author of the Outlander series, and she'll give the opening address at the Savannah Book Festival tonight at 6 p.m. You can get more details at our website, gpbnews.org. A true pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
Los Angeles musician Phoebe Bridgers is only 23, but she's already toured and collaborated with artists like Ryan Adams and Julian Baker. She was also featured in an Apple iPhone commercial in 2014. Last fall, she released her debut album, Stranger in the Alps. She's in Atlanta tonight and will likely perform one of her hit songs, Georgia. Producer Trevor Young caught up with Phoebe Bridgers last week.
Hey, I'm Phoebe Bridgers, and I'm a singer-songwriter from Los Angeles, California.
Georgia, Georgia, I love your son. When he gets older, he might be the one.
Georgia is about a kind of my first love interest. His name was Dante, and he was from Georgia, and I had never traveled really ever in my life. So I ended up going to Georgia as a teenager later, but I kind of romanticized it as a place, and he had all these crazy stories about it or kind of growing up in the woods, and I was just so fascinated and thought it was an interesting place to start a song from.
Sometimes in the pouring
Georgia definitely lived up to my expectations. When I first came here, I was afraid to death of ticks. I thought I was going to get bitten by ticks a bunch, but that didn't happen. I went to like a cute diner. I think that's the first thing I did here, so. The weirdest part about writing really personal songs isn't actually showing it to people or recording it or showing it to my friends. It's mostly singing at a show, and if someone's never heard the song before, like watching their reaction, sometimes I feel this weird guilt for like laying a lot of heavy stuff out on the line for people. I think Smoke Signals encapsulates what I'm trying to do for the most part, which is why I started the album with it. It has electronic elements, it has baritone guitar, it has kind of weirder stuff, but for the most part it's a very straight up song and there are four chords in it the whole time. So it's simple, but we played a lot with different sounds. There's pocket piano and synthesizers that I had never experimented with before on it that now I play with all the time.
I'm sleeping in my bed again and getting in my head and then walk around the reservoir. You.
I want to be the kind of artist that I could make an electronic record next and nobody would be surprised, or a folk record, or an entirely country record. I want to just have kind of creative freedom and for it not to feel like a switch tracking or a weird move. I want to be kind of loose, a loose genre is what I'm kind of going for.
I didn't know you then and I'll never understand.
That's LA musician Phoebe Bridger. She performs at Aisle 5 in Atlanta tonight at 9:30 p.m. Just ahead, your favorite cocktails that would have been illegal 100 years ago. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk with author Tayari Jones about her new novel, An American Marriage. She's a graduate of Spelman College in Atlanta, and she adds to a rich tradition of Southern writers. And we'll hear from her and other authors in a special writer's break room. And we want to hear from you. If you could sit down to dinner with any living author, who would it be? Choose your dinner companion. Call us at 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us at 9 a.m. tomorrow for that conversation and that special break room. We talked earlier this week about guns found in carry-ons at the airport, and you guys have a lot to say about that. Sam Burnham says most of the guns are loaded because they are handguns, and owners typically keep handguns loaded all the time. Stressed Desserts tweets, guest claims that people misplace guns all the time, forget that guns are in their bags. So much for the concept of the responsible gun owner. It is not okay for folks to lose track of their lethal weapons. And Pax Bobro says, my God, equating personal responsibility for a lethal weapon with a remote control is mind-blowing. That casual attitude is viscerally upsetting. And we will clean up Aaron Cohen's language here. He tweets, if you have a gun, you better know where the heck it is. We always love to hear your views, sanitized or not, so reach out on social media. And, you know, we also love Southern food on this show. But let's spend just a few minutes talking about the beverages that accompany that food. The stories behind Southern cocktails are told in the book, The Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails. I got a crash course in mixology from Sarah Camp Milam, managing editor of the Southern Foodways Alliance. And I also talked with Sarah's co-author, Jerry Slater. He's owner of the soon-to-open Athens-based restaurant and bar called The Expat. They joined me back in December. So I wanted to actually start out by playing you a clip of what's known as the whiskey speech, and this is something that you guys wrote about in the book.
This is great.
Yeah, okay. So in the 1950s, the Mississippi House of Representatives were debating whether they should end prohibition. And in 1952, a young lawmaker who is known as Soggy Sweat delivered this infamous, now infamous speech. And here's a portion of that speech actually being recited by the author, John Grisham.
If you mean that drink, the sale of which pours into our treasuries untold millions of dollars, which are used to provide tender care for our crippled little children, our blind, our deaf, our dumb, our pitiful and aged and infirm, to build highways and hospitals and schools, then certainly I am for it. This is my stand. I will not retreat from it. I will not compromise.
So, Sarah, what does the whiskey speech tell us about the Southern attitude toward drink?
Well, it really exemplifies the push and pull in of drinking alcohol in Southern culture. This you know, there's rejecting it on one side and embracing it on the other. It's religious, it's political, it's cultural. And we talk about this a little bit early in the book, but the South certainly has a conflicted relationship with alcohol. And I just love the Soggy Sweat speech. is very colorful, and even more so. That was John Grisham reading it at the Oxford conference for the book several years ago.
Yeah. So Jerry, I mean, is there an objective way to judge a good cocktail? I mean, since tastes are so varied, how do you say this is a good drink versus this is not?
Well, in most drinks, I like balance. But a couple of guiding questions. I think when I go to ask someone what they would like me to make them, first of all, what do they like to drink? And then, all those suggestions are welcome. And so we, find out what they like and then find a cocktail that might be balanced and, you know, not too sweet, not too boozy. Everything's integrated.
So we asked that question, what do you like to drink, at the Silver Skillet next door, a Southern diner if ever there were one. And here's what people said.
Well, I love an old-fashioned because I love the bourbon. And it's a very smooth drink and one that I enjoy in the evening. My wife loves a Cosmopolitan.
Hot toddies are always a big one. My roommate and I used to drink them, on cold nights, like recently.
I prefer red wine. Actually, any wine. I like white wines, too.
I would say bourbon straight up on the rocks.
So, Sarah, bourbon is a Southern liquor, is it not? That's fair?
It is. That's fair to say. It's named after Bourbon County, Kentucky, which originally was a much larger part of Kentucky than it is now. The original Bourbon County was a good chunk of the state back when Kentucky became a state. So, yes. And, in fact, we consulted with 21 bartenders from Washington, D.C. to Austin, Texas to gather the recipes for this book. And we learned quickly that when you ask bartenders for Southern recipes, the majority of them are going to give you brown liquor-based drinks, especially bourbon and rye.
What do you think of, Jerry, as sort of a quintessential Southern drink? Is it like a mint julep?
Yeah, and the mint julep is fascinating, too, because, by most accounts, it might have originated here in Georgia. It wasn't bourbon initially. It was more like peach brandy. And when we say peach brandy, yeah, not like the liqueurs that we have today, but probably more like a French Calvados, but made from peaches, aged in a barrel, sort of a boozy dark liquor. Sarah's got a great article in the book on ice and its origins and, what is now sort of Southern West Virginia and, that was the fun part about the book is that all of these historical, we have great cocktails. We have 88 cocktails, recipes in there, but all of the historical fun facts, I think we provided you with cocktail party rhetoric as well.
Yeah, there are a lot of in there. And Sarah, I wonder if there is a particular fact you uncovered that you like.
Yeah, Jerry mentions there's an essay about ice and how that transformed, the world of cocktails. And the first person to commercially make ice, so, it was originally harvested from ponds in New England and packed in a lot of sawdust and shipped to far-flung southern places where ice wasn't able to be made naturally. But the first person to make it artificially make ice in a warm region was a doctor in Apalachicola, Florida, who was trying to cure fevers. So that was one fact that was really interesting.
That is interesting that it was a medical purpose first, but quickly used to cool drinks.
Exactly.
One of those other medical purposes, the Sazerac cocktail, which, we think of as a Southern cocktail, was created by cooperation between a coffee house owner and a pharmacist, Antoine Peychaud.
In New Orleans.
Yeah.
And has since become a really, truly quintessential. We have a minute left, Jerry. Do you want to tell me a fact that maybe you didn't know before that you particularly liked?
Oh, I feel like
enjoyed writing about?
One of the ones that was really fascinating to us, even though my family's from West Virginia, I grew up in the Midwest, and I thought of the grasshopper as a kind of ice cream drink.
Yeah.
And it actually was created in New Orleans, and it's just a shaken, creamy drink created at Two Jacques, where they still serve them 150-plus years later.
And
that's interesting. I didn't read that one.
Yeah, and so it's been, you know, that was one of the surprises we saw when we polled folks and said, you know, what do you think of as a Southern drink? That came up.
So you're not going to make the, are you going to make the grasshopper without the ice cream now?
Oh, yeah.
That was Jerry Slater and Sarah Camp Milam. They're authors of the book, The Southern Foodways Alliance Guide to Cocktails. I spoke to them a couple of months ago. Georgia serves some delicious drinks, but there was, legally anyway, a long dry spell. Prohibition, the law of the land from 1920 to 1933. Georgia had its own rules about alcohol and when and where it could be bought and sold. A museum opened in Savannah last year that tells the Prohibition story from first drop to last. I talked about it in front of a live audience in Savannah with the museum's manager, Kayla Black. Turns out Savannah is a good location for that museum.
You know, you've got big names throughout the country like Al Capone and others along with him who have focused right here in Savannah. They called this the spigot of the South in the 1920s because huge amounts of liquor from the Caribbean was coming up through here and then being distributed throughout the Midwest. We were the funnel of alcohol into the Midwest of the country.
So was Savannah ever dry?
Technically, yes. In practicality, no. Savannah was never fully dry.
Well, they stood by their principles. Let's hear a little bit of tape. This is Reverend Billy Sunday. He was one of the most vocal critics of the sale of alcohol, a very strong supporter of prohibition. So here's a clip of him delivering one of his sermons.
America needs a tidal wave of the old-time religion. America needs to be taken down to God's bathhouse and the hose turned on her. And the time isn't far distant when the wheels of God's judgment are going to go sweeping through this old God-hating world.
All right, let's hear a little bit more sound. Many people will associate prohibition automatically with this group. It's the Women's Christian Temperance Union. They fought very valiantly against the distribution of alcohol. So let's hear a clip of one of their members.
I solemnly promise, God helping me, to abstain from the use of all distilled, fermented, and malt liquors, and that means wine and beer. I don't drink, and I will do all I can to keep you from drinking.
Okay, so that's one point of view. So let's play one more. This is a clip of a newsreel. So even before repeal happened in 1933, I guess a lot of cities were much like Savannah, that they just went ahead and ignored the Volstead Act. Many businesses did not wait for that repeal to serve their liquor. So here's a clip from a newsreel in 1933, that year.
The lid is off in many places, with the downfall of prohibition being celebrated in real old-time hilarity. Yes, and by the renewal of old acquaintances, hotels and nightclubs report a real pre-war spirit among those revelers. Boy!
So what do we not understand? Even though it was relatively recent, I think people don't really know the history of prohibition all that well. What do we not understand or remember about it?
When most people think about prohibition, they think, oh, there was this 13-year period where people weren't allowed to drink alcohol in the country, and that was really the long and short of it for most people. But what we're hoping to portray in the museum is that this was not just all of a sudden people were like, you know what, I think we should not drink alcohol, and then they turned it on and turned it back on, or turned it off and then turned it back on. This was a process that started basically from the beginning of our country and lasts even till today. We have prohibition groups in the country that are still trying to push for national prohibition. The Prohibition Party is still an active organization in the country. So many of the different things that we have today have direct roots in prohibition. Organized crime, the income tax was passed as an amendment just so that we could have prohibition. Lots of different little things about our lives today have direct ties to prohibition and that 13 years.
Okay, so let's hear again a little bit more tape. And this is John D. Rockefeller. Obviously, most of us know him now as a philanthropist, very wealthy industrialist. He was against prohibition, and it was for what that unintended consequence, which was the creation of organized crime. So here is a little bit of John D. Rockefeller speaking in 1932, calling for the repeal of prohibition.
Many of our best citizens piqued at what they regarded as an infringement of their private rights have openly and unabashed disregarded the 18th Amendment, that as an inevitable result, respect for all law has been greatly lessened, that crime has increased.
So what ended up killing the Volstead Act? Was it the crime?
You have to look at what the Volstead Act was as a whole. So the 18th Amendment was the first time in American history where an amendment had been passed that limited the rights of Americans. Almost every other law and amendment that had been passed expanded the rights of the American people, and this one really curtailed it. It also destroyed a large an amount of industry. And ultimately, when you come to in the 1930s, we've got the combination of the Great Depression and needing to find jobs for people, and the mere fact that you can't legislate morality. You can't what ultimately happened is people were looking at this saying this was something that was legal and fine, now it's illegal, and it was opening up pathways for small criminals to become big time criminals, which is where we have the mob lords of Al Capone and Lucky Luciano, who were just small time folks who used alcohol as a way to break into the big leagues.
Do we have any idea how much alcohol was landing on Savannah's shores during the time of Prohibition?
No, we're not exactly sure. It was a lot, though. one of the most famous names of the time period, Bill McCoy, he was very frequent into Savannah. His very first trip from the Caribbean bringing alcohol into the States was here into Savannah. And it really just flowed through. At one point, Savannah had more than 700 blind tigers, which were little tiny juice joints around the city.
Like speakeasies?
Like little tiny speakeasies, little personally owned speakeasies throughout the city. And it was not hard for you to find a drink. There's one story that says, if you came into Savannah and you tried to find how long it took to get a drink, it took about 3 minutes for you to find some place that would serve you booze during Prohibition.
Well, that's time is much shorter now.
Yeah, even shorter.
Yeah. So in the minute that we have left, what remains? Do we still have some of this history in Savannah? Can you walk around and find some of these?
Oh, absolutely. We've got the remnants of Prohibition today with blue laws, where in Savannah you can't buy a drink of alcohol until 12:30 on Sunday in the afternoon, and that's a very recent. It used to be no alcohol on Sundays whatsoever, and that's directly from Prohibition itself.
That's Kayla Black. She's the manager of the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah. To plan a visit to the museum, visit gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear about your favorite mixed drinks, even if they're non-alcoholic. You can call us with the recipe at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.